puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago. Now, this episode of Abandoned Manitoba seems to be shrouded in mystery, laden with question marks. It's all very exciting. Gordon Goldsborough is here to fill us in. Hi, Gordon.
Good morning, Nadia.
So what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about a Manitoba city that I suspect nobody has heard of, and it was designed by a Manitoba architect that nobody has heard of, who also discovered a Manitoba mineral that nobody has heard of.
So that's a lot to think about. Let's start with the city, first of all.
Well, last week we discussed an abandoned science lab in Churchill. Well, this week we're staying in Churchill, but you might not have known it, because back in 1912, over 100 years ago, there was a proposal to build a city for no less than a 500,000 residents on the present-day site of Churchill and name it Roblin City. Well, of course, things didn't quite turn out that way, because the population of Churchill today is under 1,000 people.
All right, so let's start with the first question. Why was it going to be called Roblin City?
Well, in 1912, when this proposal was floated, the Manitoba Premier was a fellow named Rodmond Roblin, who was the grandfather of later Premier Duff Roblin. Rodmond presided over a period of relative prosperity and growth in the province, and his name was given to a number of things, including the town of Roblin on the Saskatchewan border, the rural municipality of Roblin in southwestern Manitoba, and of course, here in Winnipeg, Roblin Boulevard, among other places. Unfortunately for Mr. Roblin, his political career ended abruptly in 1915 when he resigned because of a corruption scandal over construction of the legislature. I suspect that the promoters of Roblin City thought that by attaching themselves to the Roblin name, the proposal would get attention and hopefully, I guess, development would proceed.
But it doesn't look like it did.
No. It's yet another example of a grandiose plan that never came to fruition, mostly, I think, in this case, because it was just so ridiculous. So there are street maps of Roblin City that were published back in 1912. There's a wonderful, colorful version of that map preserved at the Provincial Archives, and it shows over 600 miles of streets and streetcar lines, a full range of municipal amenities, including public parks and green spaces, even a university and a medical school. The population density that they planned for Roblin City was about 13,000 people per square mile, and that's over triple what Winnipeg has today. You know, this was going to be a huge city where Churchill is, and the plans were just so hopelessly inappropriate for the place. The layout of Roblin City made absolutely no provision for the harsh climate that exists in northern Manitoba. You know, and that makes me think that the designer never visited the place, you know, and experienced that climate firsthand.
Yeah, so who was the designer?
It was a fellow named William Bruce. Bruce was a Scottish-born architect. He came to Winnipeg in 1906. He had had a relatively modest architectural career in Scotland to that point. And, you know, he really didn't set the world on fire in terms of architecture here in Manitoba. To our knowledge, only five buildings that he designed survive today. There's the Garrick Hotel on Gary Street, the Beveridge Block on Main Street, the Chateau Apartments on Spence Street, the Laclede Apartments on Simcoe, and I think most notably, since none of those buildings probably are terribly familiar, the Ukrainian Cultural and Educational Center. It's also known as the Saradok, near the Manitoba Museum. That's perhaps his most noteworthy building. The last of these buildings was built in 1914, and Mr. Bruce disappears from the historical record around 1918. We have no idea where he ended up. It's possible he returned to Scotland because his wife died there in 1915.
Did anything ever come of the plans for Roblin City?
Well, you know, until recently, if you had asked me, I would have responded nothing. But just a few weeks ago, my friend Heidi Denhan shared some photos that were taken at Churchill near Cape Mary. And if you're not familiar with sort of the layout of Churchill, that's near the mouth of the Churchill River. There's a whole series of large sort of flat rocks at the site. And etched into one of those large rocks is a small plus sign along with the names Center Street and Second Avenue. Now, there's no streets anywhere near there, but it is close to the spot on the Roblin City map that I mentioned where a central street would have been. And what that suggests is that this etching on the stone might have been some kind of surveyor's marking of the proposed streets of Roblin City. At least that's one theory. Another theory for the etchings actually came from my good friend Mike Goodyear, who lives in Churchill. He shared a map of the town that was published in 1932, a few years later, after the railway arrived in Churchill. And that map shows another network of streets, somewhat less elaborate than William Bruce's plan, that likewise never developed. And that map does show a Center Street and Second Avenue near the rock markings. So either way, these etchings in the rock preserve one of the only signs of what the Boosters had hoped that Churchill would become, but never did.
Okay, so we've covered the unheard-of city, Roblin City. We've talked about the unheard-of designer, William Bruce. But what about the mineral that you mentioned at the top of the conversation? What was that about?
Well, another detail of William Bruce's work here in Manitoba was his advocacy for a mineral that he called Manitobite. Well, of course, you can tell where it gets its name. In 1912, the same year that he was pushing for Roblin City, he established a company. It was backed by investors with $250,000 in funding. That was a pretty considerable sum in those days. And he was its president. The company was called the Manitobite Stoneworks. In fact, it wasn't one of these sort of on paper companies that you never actually hear about. This company actually did open a quarry near the village of Broad Valley that's located in the Interlake. Now, I should tell you a little bit about what Manitobite was. It's a form of limestone, which is, of course, quite common in parts of Manitoba. This one is dark yellow in color, but apparently it's much harder than most limestone. Well, limestone is generally a fairly soft rock, but apparently Manitobite was harder than granite, which is pretty amazing. You know, in fact, it was said to be an acceptable substitute for marble. And in fact, William Bruce lobbied hard for Manitobite to be used in the construction of the legislative building because, of course, it was being built at this time. Well, unfortunately for Mr. Bruce, the architect of the ledge dismissed this hype about the virtues of Manitobite, so it wasn't ever used in the building itself. And in fact, as far as we know, the only place where Manitobite was used is in an entrance staircase of the Tier Building at the University of Manitoba. Well, Bruce's quarry in the Interlake closed in 1915, possibly because of a labor shortage during the First World War, or possibly because they simply exhausted the supply of Manitobite. The quarry apparently was quite a shallow one. There wasn't a lot of stone there. And the hole that they had created was apparently backfilled, so there's no sign of it today. The company, well, it was dissolved in 1925, and its investors, they were left with nothing but worthless assets.
So it seems the only tangible evidence of Mr. Bruce's legacy are those buildings that are around Winnipeg that you mentioned and a staircase at the University of Manitoba.
That's true. And, well, and maybe some rock etchings at Churchill. We're not quite sure about those. But, you know, this story, I think, is so indicative of the many once prominent people who have disappeared from public memory here in Manitoba.
Until now. Gordon, thank you so much for this.
You're quite welcome, Nadia.
What's up for next week?
Well, the Manitoba Historical Society has on its website a collection called Memorable Manitobans. You know, I'm picking up the theme of, you know, once prominent people because we have over 11,000 short biographies of deceased Manitobans. Many of them are just not that memorable today. And in the collection, for example, are names like Harvey Kavanagh, Florence McGregor, and my all-time favorite, Ginger Snook. These are all but forgotten today. There are a few of the fascinating people in Manitoba's history who I think deserve to be remembered.
I mean, I think you have enough content for 11,000 episodes of A Band of Manitoba, potentially memorable Manitobans. That could be your next series. Love that name, Ginger Snook. Sounds naughty. Gordon, thank you so much.
We'll talk next week. Bye-bye.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, put puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.